But today there definitely is a title, and it's Keep It Personal. Keep It Personal. My wife and I have been sorting through basically the detritus of our entire lives in the last couple months after a move. If anybody needs boxes, please contact me. But we've been getting rid of a lot of things. We moved everything over with the idea that we would see what fit and we would get rid of the rest. Garage sale this Thursday. One of the things that I was going through and parted with after a little bit of thought was I had a folder. It was a tall and slender folder, and my sister had sent it to me after my father died, and it was every business card he had ever collected from every person he had ever encountered. And it went all the way back to the 40s when he was at West Point and his Army buddies were there. It had many of my relatives, it had many of my old business cards, but one of the things that I was impressed with is that my father's life was a collection of people. And he prepared us for when he and my mother would be gone, and they died about 10 years ago. And what he would tell us, he wouldn't say, well, there's the files. He would say, you talk to Doris at the bank, you talk to my attorney, Kenny, in Gainesville, you talk to my investor, Lou, in St. Louis. That was easy to remember. And it was people. It was always people. My father, when he went to the bank, he pictured Doris. He didn't picture a money institution. He pictured a woman who helped him. And that was the way his life was, and that was the way life tended to be back then. You knew people. I remember one of the figures in my life was Mr. Knowles. Mr. Knowles, we all knew each other in Newcastle, Pennsylvania, pretty much. I went to school with his daughter, but Mr. Knowles was the shoe salesman at Penny's. Now, that may not sound like a big thing to you, but my mother spent a lot of time with her five children in the shoe department at Penny's. And Mr. Knowles knew the Graham feet very well. Mr. Knowles loved it when the Grahams came because shoes were sold. But it wasn't just going to Penny's for shoes, it was going to see Mr. Knowles. As I said, I decided to part with them, but these were things that meant a great deal to him, people. He was quite a communicator. He stayed in touch with his West Point buddies. My last assignment before he died, and actually I was very honored to receive this assignment, was they had graduated to the point of email. Now, that doesn't mean my dad had a computer. He had what was called Web TV. It was the most archaic system that barely put him in the email category. But my job when he died was I was to notify his West Point buddies, and he dictated the message to me down to the periods and commas and signatures, and it was to be signed by him, even though they would understand that at that point he was gone. And when one of their West Point buddies died, the heading was always man down, and that's what I remembered. I had to send the man down message after my father died, but it meant a great deal to him that this message got through to people, because he kept things personal in his life. Many of us have gone through real estate transactions recently. I know Lois and Frank and Josie, don't even talk to the Dursteins about moving. But you know, there's always stress involved. And I've sold and bought houses over the course of a life, not many, but enough to stay housed at least. And it used to be a slightly kinder, more personal thing. When we bought our first house, we met the people. We walked in on the people when we saw the house. They were sitting there. They actually were piano customers of mine. I didn't realize it till we got in the house. I don't always remember people, but I never forget a piano. And that's my way of keeping it personal, I guess. But I remember that first transaction. We worked it out. We worked out a price. They needed to stay in the home for a while, so they actually paid us rent. But we worked it out. We knew the Lewises. We knew where they moved to. Nowadays, your realtors work very hard, and I'm not disparaging realtors. There's reasons for doing this, to make sure that the buyer and seller never meet. We never met the people that we bought this recent house from, nor did we meet the people at the time that we bought our previous house from. They keep you separate. They don't want your paths to cross at all. And it turns into sometimes a very sordid transaction. People want things, and they don't see you as a person. They see you as somebody to get things from. We had all kinds of ups and downs and glitches in our real estate life this summer. My sister texted me this morning and was telling me about hers, and she said, why does it have to be so angry and so confusing and so greedy? And I think one of the reasons is you don't meet the people. When we left our last house after not particularly liking the people who bought it and definitely not liking their real estate agent, because they were just insulting about all kinds of things, but I sent them a letter. And I said, look, here's my address and my phone number. You might have questions about the house. I said, I know things didn't go really smoothly, but I want you to know that there was a human being who sold you that house, and you might have questions for me. What I didn't put in the letter was some of my customers might accidentally send checks to that address, too, and I wanted them to have a forwarding address for that. But they'll figure that part out. You know, when we bought our house before, there was a woman there who went into assisted living and eventually died, and she would get checks to our address. She got checks the entire time we lived there for 7 years, even including 4 years after she died. And I finally hunted down her son. It was a name that wasn't very common, and I found a son, and I said, your mother is getting piles of money at our address, and it appears you don't even know about this. And, you know, many times, people don't tell their children all the financial arrangements and things, so I'm not blaming the children, but it was just weird. I had no way of forwarding these things. It was money, real checks, and I'm told they're still coming. Our realtor says they haven't stopped because the people had questions, and they look like checks, and I open them up, and they are checks. You'd think the company who's writing the checks would eventually figure it out after they don't get cashed for 7 years, but whatever. It's because there's no personal transactions. It's harder and harder in life to keep things personal. You know what it's like going to the doctor. I remember my mother saying, the doctors get younger every time I go. And in the old days, we had our doctor. My pediatrician's name was Dr. Growl, and there was no doctor more aptly named because, among other things, Dr. Growl was a very small doctor, and the Graham family consisted of very large children. And we would sit there on the table, and Dr. Growl would growl. He just, for some reason, he was a good enough doctor, and I went to school with his daughter, Barbara Growl. That's the way it was. But nowadays, I go to my doctor. My doctor's name happens to be William Dam. He's a fine doctor, D-A-M-M. I just like saying that, Dr. Dam, Dr. Dam. But I don't always know if I'm going to see him. I often see a physician's assistant, which is absolutely fine. They're very good and very personable, but I'm never sure that I'm really going to see Dr. Dam. I might be going to see Rosalie, who is one of the physician's assistants, and they're all very helpful, and I like it, but I don't know that they'll be there the next visit. I will say that doctors and other medical staff have now gone out of their way, because they're being trained, to be more personal and to listen more and to connect more with the patient, and I appreciate that. That helps. But it still doesn't mean that I'll know who I'm going to see when I walk in the door. The internet has changed things quite a bit. In some ways, it might have been, you know, the advent of the smartphone. Steve Jobs has a lot to answer for. He may have been a brilliant man, but he changed the world, and not all for the better, as you know. Some of it's great, of course. But in other ways, the internet has led to a big decrease in personal connections. And you think, what? Because I can call a friend in Australia right now and talk to him. But no, that's not the way it happens. Nowadays, we spend times, you know, on the internet, on screens and things like that. But also, you can hide behind the internet, and you can make comments on other people's comments. And in some ways, it has had a factor, I feel, very strongly in the deterioration of our nation and the world's ability to govern itself, because it used to be that we had a governing class. Now, in America, we don't say that. We deny that. We say we're all equal. But we did. You know, it was old, rich, white guys who ran the country for a long time. And now it's not so. We don't trust them to do it, and we criticize them at every turn. And You can be the kindest, most wonderful person and put something on the internet that you think is a wonderful thing, and you will get savaged by people. It's just the way that it is. And one of the reasons is they don't think that they're talking to a person. They're hiding behind an electronic identity, and they feel that they can get away with that because you'll never find them. And in some cases, that's true. It's a very mean, hideous place. And I find myself now not wanting to pick up my phone. I don't answer phone calls if I don't have to. And I although I am a person who likes and uses Facebook quite a bit, I've shied away from it now because there's just so much meanness in the world and so much impersonality. It's harder and harder to keep it personal. And yet God's plan from the very beginning, before mankind was ever made, while they were still in the planning stages, God's plan was about keeping it personal. Him wanting personal connections with other beings, and also he wants other beings to have personal connections. The plan from the very beginning was that God would be with people. When the Garden of Eden was made, God walked in the garden, and Adam and Eve knew God. They didn't have a camera to take a picture of God and post it on Facebook, and they didn't have any Facebook friends either, but it would have been very interesting. All they had to talk with at that point was God and the odd random serpent that wandered through. But it was personal. God was with them. And you know those beginning stories. He talked to not just Adam and Eve, but he talked to Cain and Abel. And you come to a very odd verse in Genesis 4. I'm going to assume you know the story of the Garden of Eden very well. But at the end of Genesis 4, before it gets into the genealogy that took place after Adam, there's a verse that's tossed off almost in passing, but it's a very important verse. It mentions that the birth of Seth in Genesis 4 and verse 25, and Eve named the baby Seth because she said, God has granted me another child in the place of Abel. Abel was a human being was beginning to have a very close connection. He was fostering a connection. And even when Jesus walked on this earth, he was still remembering Abel. He actually still mentioned Abel. He never quite got over the story of Abel. But at this point, Seth came along, and Seth also had a son and named him Enosh. So this is the third generation or the second, depending on whether you count Adam and Eve as the first generation or the zeroth. But regardless, it was before too much time had taken place. And then comes this very peculiar verse. At that time, men began to call on the name of the Lord. Now, there's all kinds of discussion and arguments about what that could mean. But the main thing that it means is he wasn't there. They had to call on him at that point because God made a change in the way things were for some reason. It's one of those things that we will understand when it's fully explained to us. But something happened at that point when God decided to back off and make things a little less personal for some reason. Men could still contact him, and as a matter of fact, he still had relationships with certain people throughout what we call the Old Testament times. But the rest of the history of the Old Testament is God not being as personal. He tried now. He tried talking with Moses. He tried talking with the nation of Israel. But what happened in Exodus, right after the Ten Commandments were delivered, right after God made a big deal about being connected with these people and speaking to them personally, the people came to Moses and said, we do not want this. We're scared. It was not like Art Blakey's song. They were really scared. And they asked that God not speak to them anymore and that he speak to Moses. They couldn't handle it. They didn't want that personal connection. And what happened over the course of millennia at that point is that human beings, even the ones who served God, and this is something we could discuss, this is my take on it, became more interested in observing religion than they did in having a relationship, a personal relationship with God, in knowing God. And that's not what God wanted. I think the most fascinating but very short stories of Genesis, we learn a little more in the New Testament about it, is that God had a relationship with a man named Enoch. And God and Enoch seem to have been very good friends. This is something I really want to know more about, but we can't know much more about Enoch at the moment. We'll have to wait till the world tomorrow. But God reached out and had a personal relationship, and they walked with each other, and there was something special going on there. And of course, he did it again. He tried to do it with a man named Terah. The man, for some reason, frustrated God's attempts to have a friendship with him, and it had to wait for his son, who was named Abraham. And so there were people throughout the Old Testament. Besides Enoch, there was Abraham, of course, Moses. Besides him, there was Sarah. Sarah actually talked with God, not as much as Abraham did, but she actually experienced a conversation with God. There was David, who seemed to have a personal relationship. He seemed to know things that other people didn't know about God. Of course, there was Elijah, who also spoke to God face to face. And there were other prophets who received things directly. But in general, people not only didn't want to have a personal relationship, they didn't want to keep things personal, but they asked that things not be personal. They wanted intercessors between them and God. First they started with Moses, and then of course it was priests. There's a very interesting passage in Isaiah 30, and we'll come back to Isaiah 30, it's a very important chapter, but that kind of summarizes this, and of course this is near the end of the story of the nation of Israel and what they had come to. Isaiah 30, the beginning of Isaiah 30 actually has one of my favorite verses in it. It has absolutely nothing to do with this sermon, but that doesn't mean we're not going to read this verse. And that is in Isaiah 30 and verse 4, where it's talking about envoys coming from Egypt. And I'm reading in the New International Version, and it says, though they have officials in Zoan, and their envoys have arrived in Haines. I've always loved that verse. This may be more information than you want, but I'm in Haines right now. And I always picture these envoys arriving in Haines, and it changes the whole story. Okay, enough of that. That's just one of those verses I don't think we should pass by unnoticed. But actually what I want to talk about is where Israel had come to at this point. And let's start in verse 8, where God is speaking to Isaiah, and he says, go now, write it on a tablet for them, inscribe it on a scroll, that for the days to come it may be an everlasting witness. These are a rebellious people, deceitful children, children unwilling to listen to the Lord's instruction. And I bet they would have argued with that, because these were God's people who had a temple and did sacrifices and made a big show about obeying the law. How can he say that about them? These are God's called out people. This is the nation of Israel. In verse 10, they say to the seers, the people who could connect them with God, they say, see no more visions. To the prophets, they say, give us no more visions of what is right. Tell us pleasant things, prophesy illusions, leave this way, get off this path, and stop confronting us with the Holy One of Israel. In other words, don't tell us what God is like and what God wants. Tell us what we want to hear. So they had the form, they had the traditions that Jesus Christ talked about later when he was on earth. They had the form of being God's people, but they really didn't want a personal relationship with God. They wanted to hear things that they thought sounded good and that made their lives pleasant. And of course, there are many parallels to that today. There are many things that we consider abominable that religious people say, oh no, Jesus would do that. Jesus, God would like that. And it just comes down to an argument. They don't know the power of the scriptures, as Jesus said, and they also don't know God well enough to know what God wants and what God doesn't want. Instead, they have a form of religion, and they have done their best, and this was the story of the nation of Israel. Although they had a shell of obeying God, they had no personal relationship with the great creator God. And he had people through the centuries with which he did, and that was both uplifting to God and uplifting to the people, and thanks to them, we have an idea of what was really in God's mind. And it's one of the reasons that the Old Testament God seems so different from the God after Jesus walked on the face of the earth, because the people really were not interested in what God was like, and he had to treat them as people like that, who had to be managed instead of friends and children of his. When Jesus came to earth, things were different. He was still remembering Abel. You know, it's interesting. He never really mentions Adam and Eve. He just assumes that the people he was talking to know about them. But if you turn to Matthew 23 and verse 35, somewhat near the end of his time on earth, Matthew 23, he mentions things that have brought him sadness. Now, at this point, he had already made the statement, "Oh, Jerusalem, I just want to take you under my wing." God wanted to love these people, and God wanted to care for these people. But this is how they treated his messengers. And he mentions 33. This was not, could not probably fall under the category of building close personal relationships. In verse 33, he calls them, "You snakes, you brood of vipers." That wasn't a bond-building thing to do, but he was making a point. How will you escape being condemned to hell? "Therefore, I am sending you prophets and wise men and teachers. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Others you will flog in your synagogues and pursue from town to town." And that had already happened, and it would happen again. Some of the early Christians' biggest persecutors were the Jewish people in the towns where they were trying to preach the gospel. In verse 35, he says, "And so upon you will come all the righteous blood that has been shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel." So Abel still had an impact on his thinking at that point, "to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar." And that's a little confusing. There was a prophet Zechariah, or a priest Zechariah, not the son of Berechiah. That's Zechariah, the man whom the book of Zechariah is named after. But there was also a priest in the time of Josiah who was killed as a martyr. At any rate, this weighed on him, all the things that he had tried to do for his children and tried to do for his nation, but they had frustrated him at every turn, and they had made it impossible to have a personal relationship with them as people. And yet, when Jesus was on earth, things were different. And it was, in a way, it was the whole point that Jesus would come to earth and Jesus would be with people and Jesus would change the game plan at that point. Jesus had close friends. He grew up under the scrutiny of his neighbors in his close-knit community in Nazareth, in Galilee, and he was watched. They knew him. They said, "We know this family. That's the carpenter and his sons and his daughters and his wife. We know these people." And yet it said that he found favor with God and men at that point, the way that he grew. You know, I read something, it was on the internet, that said, you know, you could talk about all the miracles that Jesus did, healing the sick and feeding and raising the dead and stuff like that, turning water into wine. He said, but that's child's play compared to the accomplishment of having 12 close friends when you're in your 30s. That was the real miracle, that he had pals. I don't have 12 close friends that I could hang around with. Thankfully, I do have friends. I mean, I think of you as my friends. But I spend most of my time in the company of a very nice wife and a very nice dog. I don't see most of you the rest of the time. Whereas Jesus spent his time with people, and not just the 12. I mean, there were at least 100. He very close by the end of his ministry. But he built bonds with them. He made it a personal thing. He taught them personally. He did favors for people. Most of his miracles were to make people's lives better. They were kindness. They were serving. That's the way that he was, and that's the way it was always meant to be if people would just respond that way. When he gives the talk in the book of John on the night before he died at what we call the Passover Supper, what does he say to them? He says to them, "Love is the commandment. Love is the commandment. That's what I want you to know." And he also said to them, "Me standing in front of you here, you're seeing the Father. I am taking the Father's reputation and character, and I'm putting it right here in front of you. And there is a bridge. This is personal. That if you're looking at me, you're looking at the Father." And he emphasized to them that that was personal, and the way that they treated people was very personal at that point. Matthew 7:12, I don't have to tell you, but let's turn there. You know this by heart because you've heard it since you were a little child. We had to learn this in school. We had to memorize it, and I think people still learn it whether they want to or not. Matthew 7 and verse 12, Jesus says, So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. The law and the prophets, that's basically all of Old Testament history that he's talking about. And he said, if I had to sum that up, it would be, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Now, it's not the only thing he taught, and there's other things to God's way of life. But remember also that when someone asked him what the greatest commandment was, he could only narrow it down to two, but they were both about personal relationships. One was about loving God with all your heart and soul and being, and it wasn't just, you know, sacrifice to him and keep rules. It was love him. It didn't even mention sacrifice. And the other was people, that you should love your neighbor the way that you love yourself. In other words, he was saying the people around you are the important thing in your life, and you need to build those relationships. Well, how do we do that today? What should we be doing to keep life personal the way Jesus wants us to? In Romans 12:2. Let's see. I'm going to optimistically turn to Romans 12:2. Yes, that's where I wanted to be. This is Paul writing. Paul, who was struck down and said he spent 3.5 years personally learning from Jesus himself. Paul says, do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world. Don't be those impersonal people who hide behind electronics. Be people who be out in your community. Be part of people's lives. Let them see you. It says, don't conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. In other words, that's how you know who God is. That's how you know what God's character is and what he's like. That's how you know how to behave. In 1 Peter 3:15, again, these are all verses that if you were the type of person to get tattooed, you would have tattooed on your forearm, except you don't. Because there's such well-known verses in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15. But in your hearts set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. Keep it personal. Relate to people. 1 John 3 and verse 13. This is Jesus' cousin, and as far as we know, the last living disciple apostle, and this is what he wrote near the end of his life. 1 John 3 and verse 13. Talking about people who keep it personal, he says to them, do not be surprised, my brothers, if the world hates you, because if you do that kind of thing, you aren't going to find favor in the world. But at the same time, we know that we have passed from death to life because we love our brothers. Anyone who does not love remains in death. Anyone who hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life in him. But enough of that. Now let's move on. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. He made it personal for every human being, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. So here's the key. If anyone has material possessions and sees his brother in need, but has no pity on him, how can the love of God be in him? Dear children, let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and truth. This is how we know we belong to the truth and how we set our hearts at rest in his presence whenever our heart condemns us. For God is greater than our hearts, and he knows everything. So we help people. That's one of the things that we do. In Philippians, back to the writings of Paul and chapter 2. Philippians 2, starting in verse 14. Paul's telling people how to live, how you ought to live, how you ought to relate to the world. Do everything without complaining or arguing. Is that us? It's not me. Do everything without complaining. I break that every day before breakfast. And all I talk to is the dog before breakfast. But that I complain and argue. So that you may become blameless and pure. And here's a key. Children of God without fault in a crooked and depraved generation in which you shine like stars in the universe as you hold out the word of life. In other words, you're going to be a light to the people around you. They might not even know why, but they'll know something. And you stand for righteousness and goodness and the way God wants things, and you don't compromise on it, and you let your light shine. You can do this in your community. You can do this at work. One of the pleasures I have of doing this, of building personal relationships, and of course there's many other ways, this is just one way, is that I'm lucky enough to do a lot with music. And you can do a lot with music all by yourself. You can go to a train station and play your accordion and put down a hat. You'll have very little impact on the world at that point. To have a big impact with music, you have to actually work with other people. You have to be part of a band or an orchestra or a choir, and you're forced to work with people to have the most fun possible in music. You don't have to. I read a quote from a conductor who founded the children's music programs in Venezuela, and he said that music is a conspiracy to commit beauty. I love that phrase. Music is a conspiracy to commit beauty. You have to do it together. And what you're saying to each other, whether these people are sinners or whether they're people who live God's way, what you're saying is, I'm going to do this with you, and together we're going to make something really beautiful that we couldn't do without each other. I get to do it. It's just so enjoyable for me. I think some of the closest relationships I've had with what we call non-church people, and it's not just non-church people, I can put my fingers away, they really are non-church people. But still, I've had very close, wonderful relationships with people, because when you are playing piano for somebody and they're singing, it's like it's a very close relationship if you're doing it well. I get to do that tonight, later on this evening. I still get to do it. It's one of the big thrills in my life. It's just an example, though. There are other things that you can be part of, perhaps music, but perhaps other things, sports, community groups, clubs of interest, whether you're helping, you know, people sometimes serve in service positions in their communities. Some people are homeowners association presidents, and some people are ex-homeowners association presidents and very happy about that. But the point is, we do participate. We don't just hide. We don't just hide. Matthew 5 and verse 16. We used to have a hymn in the hymnal about this. I don't know why we don't, but you'll still recognize the verses. Matthew 5 and verse 13. You are the salt of the earth, but if salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. I've had people try to explain that to me. Still don't understand. None of the salt in our house has ever lost its saltiness, but I think they're talking about rock salt, and it can just lose its properties at that point. Verse 14, you are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. And that was what God was going for in what we call the Old Testament, in the days of the nation of Israel. That was the whole idea, that they would be a light of the world, a city that couldn't be hidden. They ended up being known as a city that disobeyed their creator and went into captivity. And even in the days when Jesus, the God of the Old Testament, who is talking here, in the days that they were alive, they took a certain amount of pride in being back in their land, but they were ruled over by another government that had nothing to do with God, the Romans. So they still hadn't regained that hilltop that they had been on. And yet he says, you're the light of the world. And whether this is true for a nation, it applies to each of us individually. We want to be a light. We don't put it under a bowl. We put it on a stand, and we give light to everyone in the house. And we're not ashamed of the way that we live. We try not to be obnoxious about it. But at the same time, in verse 16, in the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. That's the connection. They see how you live, and it turns their minds to God and to connecting with God and making it personal with God. Keeping life personal is not just something that God wants to do. It's a basic human need. It's the way we're created. We think sometimes that the biggest goal in life is to hide from people, to make our own little paradise, and to stay there and to keep the rest of the world out. And sometimes that's very nice, I have to admit. I mean, my yard has a fence around it, I admit that. But at the same time, there's a basic human need, whether we recognize it or not. And one of the reasons for depression and anxiety and undue stress and many of the problems that afflict people today is the fact that we're not part of a community, is that we stay by ourselves and we don't have that internet. And when I say internet, I'm not talking about electrons anymore. I'm talking about the links between people all over the world. We don't have that community need. One of the reasons that Tay and I actually made a move this summer, you think it was to get out of being Homeowners Association president, and you would be partly right. But really what started it was we visited our daughter in Seattle, and we noticed that she lived in a very very urban, but very connected community. And there were all kinds of things going on, and people participated in them. And we started looking into things, and you know there are actual villages where you can buy houses and be part of communities like that. They're planned that way. We also couldn't afford them. We looked into them, and they tend to be in very nice, very expensive parts of the world because, you know, people say they want to be part of a community, but they want to be part of a community in a nice place, and I get that. But at the same time, there's communities right outside your door. You don't have to go that far. So we went to one where we already knew the community quite well, where I had been part of the Baldwin Wallace there for many years and where we already knew people. And you know what's happening? We're becoming part of it. We really are. It's very uplifting to me. I wake up happy in the morning. It's not just me. I don't talk about Taya very much for good reasons. I don't think you should talk too much about your family in sermons. I remember towards the end of when our children were living in this, we worked out a scale. And if I mentioned them in a sermon, they got so-and-so amount of money. And if it was a particularly gruesome story, they got it upped. And we negotiated quite a bit of that. Taya's never actually charged me for mentioning her in a sermon. That could change today. But Taya does a lot of walking the dog. And our kids have a phrase, and it goes like this. You know how mom is, unquote. Well, you know how mom is mean that mom likes to talk to people, and mom is interested in people, and mom likes to connect with people, and I'm not always that way. I'm proud to say I'm more and more of a curmudgeon with every day, but it shouldn't be. And I need to be more like mom is, and Taya's, I think she knows every dog owner within a 2-mile radius at this point. That's not even a joke. I don't think I'm exaggerating, but I hear about the people that she meets. They meet through the dog. But then she tells me about the people, and we already have friendships and hope to have more before it goes on. And I have to say, it's very uplifting. It's not the end of satisfaction because these aren't people who we share the most basic things, our relationship with God with. But at the same time, it's a beginning, and it's a wonderful thing. You know, when Christ returns, and that's a major part of our beliefs, when Christ returns, it says that he will come with heaven's armies with him. He will have to smash and kill, and his garments will get blood on them, and there'll be all kinds of things. But that part of his work is taken care of. He already has staff for that, and he's bringing them with him. We're not real sure who they are, but we know they're going to show up. And yet at the same time, in Corinthians and Thessalonians, it makes a big deal out of the fact that we are going to meet him in the air. But it doesn't mention us smashing and cutting and things like that. So what does he need us for? Like I said, it's all covered. He's got staff for it. He's got it all organized with tens of tens and thousands of beings to help him do that kind of thing. And yet, somehow we play a role. Well, when that happens, the world will be in a terrible, terrible state. The natural resources would be ruined. The sun and the moon, the very sun and moon will be darkened. The water will be poisoned. It'll be difficult just to live. There won't be food. There will be disease. There will be war. People will have lost many of the people closest to them, the ones that they did have relationships with. And people will be at their lowest ebb at that point. That's when he doesn't need the angels so much. but he needs that next army, the army that meets him in the air. Because what these beings have been doing for thousands of years, not just one human lifetime that we know, but these beings have been learning the way that God is, and they've been learning what God wants, and they've been learning the right way to live and how to do it the right way to maximize not only their own happiness, but their relationship with God the Father. They've spent whole lifetimes doing it, and I'm talking to those people. You're the people that I'm referring to. And no one will be better equipped to help those people who are facing the world at that point than people who have lived God's way. And you will be better equipped than Jesus Christ himself to help those people, because he's got the best of motives and intentions. He's totally loving at that point. He's totally powerful. But you're the people who can reach the other beings at that point who will need to be reached. And that's why we need to practice it right now, because there's going to come a time when the future of humankind depends on that, on keeping it personal. Back to Isaiah chapter 30, the Haynes chapter, as it's probably scarred in your mind from now on. Isaiah chapter 30, there's verses that are far more important to us than the ones that we read already. And it talks about how that second army will deal with people. Isaiah 30, starting in verse 18. Yet the Lord longs to be gracious to you. He rises to show you compassion. For the Lord is a God of justice. Blessed are all those who wait for him. These are the end times when he's returned. O people of Zion who live in Jerusalem, you will weep no more. You will have been through so much, but you will weep no more. How gracious he will be when you cry for help. As soon as he hears, he will answer you. Although the Lord gives you bread of adversity and the water of affliction, your teachers will be hidden no more. There will be people there. And there'll be spirit beings at that point. But you know, they won't all be spirit beings. There will also be other people who've learned to live God's way. The teachers will be hidden no more. With your own eyes, you will see them. So these aren't just disembodied voices. These are beings who resemble human beings. They used to be human. They've moved on to something better by the time we reach these verses. Whether you turn to the right or left, and it's interesting that God at this point is not talking to the converted people. He's not talking to the people who've been changed to spirit beings. He's talking to the people who are looking at these converted beings. He's looking at it from their standpoint, these unclean, unsaved people. And he's saying, whether you turn to the right or the left, and by that he means, you know, away from the straight way, your ears will hear a voice behind you saying, this is the way. Walk in it. And it doesn't say so, but then the person turning to the right or left will turn around and go, oh, a being, I can relate to this, you know? This is my teacher. We need to talk. I have so much to learn. Because this is how Jesus Christ is going to help people one at a time, by keeping it personal, even in the world tomorrow. Then you will defile your idols overlaid with silver and your images covered with gold, and you will throw them away like a filthy cloth and say to them, away with you. And what does that have to do with anything? Why does that come up right now? Because one of the reasons for the third commandment, second commandment, for not having graven images, is that images put distance between you and God. One of the reasons we don't worship images is that images are a non-living thing that represent a God, but they aren't God. And so we can be in the presence of an image and we can still demand things our own way. We need to get rid of those images and those idols and actually have a relationship with the real God and nothing in between. Verse 23, then it's those millennial verses. He will also send you rain for the seed you sow in the ground, and food that comes from the land will be rich and plentiful. In that day, your cattle will graze in broad meadows. The oxen and donkeys that work the soil will eat fodder and mash spread out with fork and shovel. And in 20, it talks about the day of great slaughter when towers fall, but it also talks about streams of water will flow on every mountain and every lofty hill. The moon will shine like the sun. The sunlight will be seven times brighter, like the light of seven full days, when the Lord binds up the bruises of his people and heals the wounds he inflicted. But when when the scripture uses the words his people, he's talking about not the teachers, but the taught. So God is reaching out to them at that point. God is keeping it personal. We know in Revelation 21, when I say Revelation 21, a picture comes into your mind of a world after what we call the millennium. In Revelation 21, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. And we look at that from our point of view, and we say, how great for us that God will be living with us. But you know what? That's not the way God looks at it. God looks at it as, this is what I had in mind from the beginning. And yes, you're important, and I appreciate your viewpoint, but this is my viewpoint, is that finally I get to live with you. Finally, I get to live with my creation and my children and make things personal. That was the way it was meant to be from the very beginning, and he knew that history and mankind would have to go through all these things for many, many centuries and millennia until this could happen. But this is the beginning. This is the beginning when God makes it personal and God comes to live with men. And we have no idea what will happen after that. But we know that it will be good, and we know that the only direction is up, and things will get more and more fantastic. Eye has not seen and ear has not heard, all those things. So past, present, future, we need to keep in our minds to keep it personal.